Welcome, everyone, to this Custom Tailored Deep Dive. If you're joining us today, it means you have an appetite for really getting to the bottom of some complex issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And today, we have a fascinating mission. This is all about you. Whether you're a policy wonk prepping for a city hall meeting, maybe an architecture buff, or just insanely curious about the physical city around you.
Right, the stuff you walk past every single day.
Exactly. We are looking at a massive, incredibly detailed stack of sources today. On the table, we've got rigorous academic studies from RAND and UCLA, some really great on-the-ground reporting from LAIST, and these highly detailed advocacy reports from the American Institute of Architects Los Angeles.
Which we'll just call the AIA LA for sure, right?
That's the AIA LA. And we're even digging into the actual, very dense legislative text of LA's proposed citywide adaptive reuse ordinance.
Which is a mouthful, but we will break it down.
We will. So our mission for this deep dive, we are going to decode the labyrinth of Los Angeles housing and development. Why is it so incredibly hard to build in LA? How do well-intentioned policies sometimes just accidentally backfire?
They really do.
And what's surprising, innovative solutions are on the horizon as the city races toward the 2028 Olympics.
It's so great to be diving into this with you. For everyone listening, my goal today is to help connect the dots. The housing crisis often feels like this massive abstract cloud, you know?
Totally. Just overwhelming.
But when we actually look at the data, it's a series of very concrete interconnected gears. So today we're going to draw the lines between an empty office building downtown, state transit laws, and the hidden economics of construction.
The mechanics of how a city actually grows.
Right. Or in some cases, how it stalls out entirely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Yeah. Because to really understand how a city stalls out, we have to start with the paradox of well-intentioned policies.
Yeah. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, as they say.
Exactly. And our sources point heavily to Measure ULA. Most people know this as the mansion tax.
Right, passed by voters in late 2022.
Yeah, and on paper, the intent was just incredibly straightforward. You apply a 4% tax to properties selling for over $5 million and a 5.5% tax to properties over $10 million.
And you use that money to fund affordable housing and rent relief.
Sounds like a perfect Robin Hood scenario, right? Tax the ultra-wealthy's mansions to build affordable housing for everyone else.
It's a great pitch.
So how did something with such a straightforward premise backfire so badly?
What's fascinating here is how the data tells a much more complicated story than that original pitch. The UCLA and RAND researchers looked really closely at the numbers.
They compared the city of LA with other parts of LA County, right?
Exactly. Parts of the county that do not have this specific tax. And they found that Measure ULA has had severe unintended consequences. It caused a roughly 18% drop in new apartment construction among projects with 20 or more units.
Wow. 18%?
Yeah. In raw numbers, that is a reduction of about 1,910 housing units being built per year.
Wait, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around that right. A tax designed to fund housing actually stopped almost 2,000 apartments from being built every single year.
That's what the data shows.
How does that actually work?
It comes down to what is physically being taxed. A property selling for $5 million or $10 million isn't always a sprawling Beverly Hills mansion.
Right. $5 million in LA real estate isn't just mansions.
Not at all. Very often, it's just a piece of dirt intended for a 50-unit apartment building. Or it's an existing mid-sized apartment complex.
I see.
Because modern housing development relies on incredibly tight financing margins, hitting a newly built apartment building with a massive 5% tax, the moment it gets sold to a long-term operator, it often just kills the underlying math.
The numbers just don't pencil out anymore.
Right. The developers just choose to build in a different city instead.
And reading through the UCLA and RAND studies, the irony of that gets even deeper.
Because of the subsidized units?
Exactly. Because of how modern development works, most large market rate buildings use state density laws to include a percentage of subsidized affordable units literally bundled inside them.
Right, alongside the market rate ones.
Yeah. So by suppressing market rate construction, the city is actually losing about 168 low-income apartments a year.
That is the core of the paradox. The tax is technically costing the city the exact type of housing it was designed to create.
It's wild.
And another critical finding from that study is that this heavily impacts non-residential properties, too. We're talking commercial buildings, industrial properties, multifamily complexes.
The commercial side got hit, too.
Big time. Those transactions fell by 30 to 50%. And a healthy city relies on property turnover to revitalize struggling commercial areas, right? And to raise property tax revenue.
So when you choke that turnover, it has a ripple effect across the entire local economy. That ripple effect really reminds me of another massive policy paradox highlighted in the RAND reports. Proposition HHH and Project Labor Agreements, or PLAs.
Right. Prop HH was huge.
Yeah. It was a massive bond measure designed to build permanent supportive housing for people experiencing chronic homelessness. But the city required many of these projects to use PLAs, which mandate union construction labor.
And when RAND looked at the cost data from completed Prop HHH projects, they found that the PLA requirement added 21% to the total development costs.
21% is a huge premium.
It is. And a large part of what is driving that cost effect isn't just the higher hourly wages. It's that these projects experience significantly longer completion times.
And time is money in construction.
Absolutely. The longer a construction project drags on, the more expensive it becomes to carry the financing, pay for the insurance, maintain the site. It all adds up.
We should take a quick second here just to be crystal clear for anyone listening. We need to point out that the RAND researchers aren't making a political argument against unions or PLAs here.
No, not at all.
And neither are we. We're just reporting the facts from the studies. They are simply running the math on how policy goals like supporting fair labor, ensuring good wages, or raising revenue through taxes, how those inevitably trade off with construction speeds and raw development costs.
That's exactly right. We aren't taking sides on unions or affordable housing mandates. It is just about acknowledging the profound friction between what we want to achieve as a society and the raw mathematical realities of what it costs to achieve it.
Right. The tension is undeniable in the data. You have a finite amount of public money, and every policy requirement attached to that money reduces the total number of housing units you can actually produce.
It's a mathematical reality that policymakers just have to weigh.
Speaking of mathematical realities, here's where it gets really interesting. I want to look at the sheer scale of the bureaucratic labyrinth. In the advocacy reports from the AIA-LA, they point to a statewide initiative called the Roadmap Home.
Which sets some pretty ambitious targets.
It's very ambitious. It says California needs 1 million affordable homes to meet its current goals. But the jaw-dropping detail in the timeline. At our current pace of production, do you know how long it would take to build those homes?
The report said 70 years.
70 years. Most of the people listening to this right now won't even be around to see that finished.
It is a profoundly sobering timeline, and the AIA-LA sources pinpoint the root cause, which isn't just a lack of funding.
It's the system itself.
Yes. It is a completely siloed, fragmented government structure. To build anything in LA, developers have to navigate a labyrinth of 12 different city departments.
12.
12. We are talking about city planning, building and safety, water and power, the fire department, urban forestry, and on and on. There's no single point of accountability anywhere in that chain.
I saw that example they cited about the affordable housing projects, specifically the supportive housing through Project Home Key.
The permitting nightmare.
Yes. They noted instances where a project took 20 to 25 months just to get a permit. That wasn't construction time. That was just waiting for paperwork.
Just sitting in limbo.
Because the fire department might demand a wider driveway, but then Water and Power says there's a utility line in the way, and Urban Forestry says you legally cannot touch the tree that's blocking the utility line.
That is the daily reality of development in LA. The architects refer to this as the capital versus cost paradox.
And I loved the analogy they used for that. They said, imagine you are trying to grow a forest. You can have all the nutrients in the world, right?
Yeah, nutrients being the money.
Right, like a proposed $10 billion statewide housing bond to subsidize the work. But if the soil is toxic, the trees won't grow.
And the toxic soil is the bureaucracy.
Exactly. The toxic soil in this analogy is regulatory delays and CEQA lawsuits. We should quickly define that. CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act.
A law from the 70s.
Yeah, originally meant to protect the environment. But today, the sources note, it's often used as a legal weapon by project opponents to just stall development for years. These endless delays and lawsuits are withering away the capital. It's costing an estimated $75,000 per home just in bureaucratic waste.
So the obvious question becomes, how do we fix the soil? The AIA LA proposes some serious structural reforms to tackle this. One of their main pushes is creating a permanent chief design officer mandated in the city charter.
Or development services are in the mayor's office, right?
Exactly. They want someone who actually has the real authority to knock heads together and force these 12 departments to coordinate. They call this the multiplier effect.
I really like that concept.
It makes sense, because if you cut the red tape and save that $75,000 per unit we just talked about, that $10 billion bond money goes exponentially further. You build thousands more homes with the exact same amount of money just by being efficient.
And this ties directly into a massive catalyst looming on the horizon for the city, the 2028 Olympics.
The ultimate deadline.
Because the city is actually proving that they can be efficient when they want to be. Right now, they're actively streamlining approvals for Olympic projects to make sure everything is ready in time for the opening ceremonies.
The architects are basically looking at that and saying, hey, if we can do this for a two-week sports event, why can't we do it for the housing crisis?
Right. That is the ultimate legacy the city could build. The AIA, LA, is urging the city to permanently adopt this zoning certainty and this interdepartmental expedited review unit for all community-focused and affordable housing projects. Not just the sports venues.
Moving from reactive crisis management to a proactive, streamlined system could entirely change the trajectory of the city. But streamlining the paperwork isn't the only battleground here.
No, it's just the first hurdle.
There is also a massive fight over where this new housing should actually be built.
So if cutting red tape is one part of the battle, the other massive elephant in the room is figuring out where all these new buildings are going to go, especially around our new transit lines.
This brings up state law SB 79.
Right, signed by Governor Gavin Newsom. Essentially, this law mandates that cities allow taller apartment buildings up to 9 stories tall right next to subway stations and mid-sized buildings within a half mile of light rail and rapid bus stops.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the state government telling local governments that if they are going to invest billions of taxpayer dollars in transit infrastructure, they have to actually allow enough people to live near the transit to ride it.
Which makes sense.
It is a core tenet of modern urban planning, but many Los Angeles leaders are pushing back. Historically, LA has preferred to keep the vast majority of its residential land strictly zoned for single-family homes.
The classic LA sprawl.
Exactly. So the state law has a built-in delay lever, allowing cities to postpone the broadest effects of SB 79 until 2030. But to pull that lever, the city council has to agree to upzone other neighborhoods right now to make up for those delayed housing units.
And the Ellis reporting paints a really vivid picture of the tension this is causing on the ground. You have homeowners in single-family neighborhoods, like Shelley Wagers with the Beverly Grove Neighborhood Association, arguing that SB 79 will run a stake through the heart of single-family neighborhoods.
That it'll cause irreversible harm to historic districts.
Exactly. These are the folks often labeled as NMBYs, which stands for Not In My Backyard. On the other side, you have housing advocates, often called YMBYs, yes, in my backyard.
Like Scott Epstein from Abundant Housing LA.
Right. They argue that high-resource neighborhoods with great transit, high incomes, and good schools absolutely must do their part to solve the housing crisis, rather than just pushing all the density into lower-income areas.
It is a massive clash of visions for what Los Angeles should look like in the 21st century.
It really is.
And again, we need to insert a clear disclaimer here. Our goal is not to take a side in the YMBY versus MBY debate.
Or to weigh in on whether the state should override local control.
Exactly. We are just mapping out the complex realities of modern urban planning and showing how massive state mandates collide with deep-seated neighborhood identities. But if you look closely at the text of SB 79, as highlighted by the architect's report, there are strict guardrails built in to balance these concerns.
What kind of guardrails? Because the fear from homeowners is usually that developers will just come in and bulldoze everything.
The law includes explicit anti-displacement rules. It strictly prohibits projects from requiring the demolition of occupied multifamily housing or most rent-controlled units.
Okay, so you can't just tear down an affordable fourplex to build a luxury high-rise.
Precisely. And it allows local jurisdictions to use implementation deferrals in areas with designated historic resources. It isn't just a free-for-all for developers. It is targeted specifically at commercial corridors and areas that won't displace existing renters.
It's fascinating how much friction is generated just trying to find an empty patch of dirt to build on.
It's exhausting just to track it all.
Which makes the next concept we're looking at feel like a breath of fresh air. Let's talk about the buildings that are already sitting there, already built, completely empty.
Adaptive reuse.
Yes, the golden ticket. The RAND study points out that repurposing underutilized commercial properties like empty office buildings or old hotels could theoretically provide between 9% and 14% of LA County's total housing needs over the next 8 years.
That is huge.
That's up to 113,000 units of housing hidden in plain sight.
It is an incredible opportunity. But the RAND researchers are careful to point out the economic nuances here. Converting hotels and motels is highly feasible because they are already chopped up into individual rooms.
They already have their own plumbing and windows.
Exactly. Vacant office buildings, however, are much trickier physically and financially.
Why is that? Because from the outside, a big glass office tower looks perfect for apartments.
Imagine a massive, square, corporate office building from the 1980s. The center of that building is often 40 or 50 feet away from the nearest window.
Oh, right.
To legally and practically build an apartment, you need natural light and ventilation in the bedrooms. So the financial feasibility of an office conversion depends heavily on the size of the residential units you are building. Larger 1- and 2-bedroom apartments are generally financially infeasible in these deep office buildings because of those windowless centers.
Because you just end up with a ton of dead space in the middle.
Right. But denser studio apartments or projects that physically cut a courtyard right down into the center of the building show a lot more promise.
And it seems the city of LA actually recognizes these physical hurdles, which is why they are pushing the new citywide adaptive reuse ordinance. They are taking the incredibly successful 1999 downtown ordinance, which, by the way, single-handedly created about a third of the 37,000 new housing units in downtown since 2000.
A massive success.
And they're expanding it to the whole city. I was reading through the text of this new ordinance, and it looks like they're practically giving developers a golden ticket. How are they actually changing the rules to make this work?
The mechanics of this new ordinance are genuinely genius. The old 1999 law was tied to a fixed date. A building had to be built before July 1st, 1974 to qualify.
Which made sense 20 years ago.
But today, we have buildings from the 90s and 2000s that are sitting totally empty. The new ordinance introduces a rolling clock. If a building is 15 years or older, it gets a by-right, fast-tracked approval process to be converted to housing.
And just to clarify for the listener, by-right means if a developer follows the zoning rules, the city has to approve it. There are no special city council hearings, no endless community debates, no subjective denials. It is a guaranteed green light.
Precisely. It removes the political risk from the project. And if a building is between 5 and 15 years old, it can still be converted, but it requires approval from a zoning administrator.
So it still has a path.
Yes. The policy recognizes that even relatively new office buildings might be completely obsolete in a post-pandemic world of remote work.
So the approval process is way faster. But what about those physical hurdles you mentioned? What are the actual incentives getting developers to spend millions converting these deep, dark buildings?
This is where it becomes a masterclass in removing friction. First, developers are entirely exempt from minimum unit sizes. If they need to build micro studios to make the deep floor plates work, which the RAND study identified as the most feasible path, they're legally allowed to do so.
That solves the layout issue.
Second, they don't have to add any new parking. They just keep whatever physically exists. And if they convert some of that parking space into housing, the city won't penalize them for it.
I also saw something in the text called the floor area reallocation rule, and I totally geeked out over this.
It's a great provision.
If a developer cuts a massive hole in the middle of a bulky office building to create a courtyard for natural light, solving that windowless center problem we talked about, they don't lose that valuable square footage.
Right, they get to keep it.
They are allowed to take the square footage they remove from the center and build new rooftop amenity structures, like lounges or shade structures, completely exempt from normal height limits. It's such a pragmatic trade-off.
It really is. But my absolute favorite detail in the ordinance is the legacy small business provision.
Oh, yes. This is fantastic.
Often, when an old commercial building is renovated into luxury apartments, the beloved corner diner or the mom-and-pop shop on the ground floor gets priced out and evicted. Under this new ordinance, if an adaptive reuse project retains a business that has been operating in Los Angeles for 20 years or more, the developer gets a massive floor area bonus.
Yeah, it's huge. They get to build extra residential square footage equivalent to 2 times the square footage of that small business.
That is brilliant. It perfectly aligns the developer's financial incentive for more rentable space with the community's desire to protect beloved local shops from gentrification.
So what does this all mean? We have covered a staggering amount of ground in this deep dive.
We really have.
We've looked at how well-intentioned taxes can accidentally stall housing projects before a shovel ever hits the dirt. We've looked at how bureaucratic red tape and lawsuits burn through millions of dollars of public funding.
The toxic soil.
Exactly. We've explored the fierce neighborhood battles over upzoning near new transit lines. And finally, the brilliant mechanics of turning dead office space into vibrant apartments. The ultimate takeaway here is that there is no single magic bullet for the housing crisis.
No, there really isn't.
You can't just pass a bond or a single tax or one zoning law and fix it overnight. The solution lies in fixing the invisible plumbing of policy. It requires untangling the unintended consequences of our regulations, breaking down city department silos, and getting incredibly creative with the buildings we already have.
And bringing this directly back to your everyday life, the next time you walk past an empty 10-year-old office building, or the next time you're waiting at a brand new light rail stop, you aren't just looking at concrete and steel anymore.
You're seeing the Matrix.
You will now see the invisible, high-stakes policy wars happening right in front of you. You will understand why that apartment building across the street stalled out, or why that old hotel is suddenly being gutted and transformed. You'll see the rolling clock of adaptive reuse and the transit density battles shaping the future of your neighborhood.
It totally changes how you see the physical landscape of the city.
It does. And before we wrap up, this raises an important question, something for you to mull over long after this audio stops playing.
Okay, lay it on us.
It comes directly from point 9 of the AIA LA's recommendations. As we discussed, Los Angeles is pouring massive resources, time, and money into the 2028 Olympic Games. They are building athlete villages and massive temporary structures. What is the proactive strategy for post-Olympics infrastructure conversion?
That is an incredible point to consider.
Wait, rather than letting those temporary Olympic facilities become massive white elephants, abandoned structures that just drain city resources for years, could those athlete villages bypass that 70-year bureaucratic backlog entirely?
Well,
could the city pre-plan the permits right now so that the moment the closing ceremonies end, those buildings are immediately adaptively reused into public housing or commercial assets? We have the Olympic streamlining in place. The question is whether we have the foresight to use it for the decades that follow.
A brilliant question to leave off on, and a perfect example of how policy choices today shape the city of tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you walk away seeing your city in a whole new light. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and we'll catch you on the next one.